Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Reading author Joel Stotti McClure has been a global trekker since the 1970s. He lived in France for over 30 years working as a journalist before he decided to walk around the Mediterranean. He wrote three books about his treks. The first 4,401 kilometers are covered in his book, The Idiot and the Odyssey, Walking the Mediterranean. But Joel Stotti McClure is also a swimmer, and just before his 76th birthday, he made news internationally for swimming in the Seine River in Paris. Swimming in the Seine because it was supposed to be cleaned up. Joel Stotti McClure, bienvenue.
Nancy, so great to see you again. It's been years.
You know, on the 17th of July, I get a video from a neighbor. I told about you swam in the river. And he sent me a video from MSNBC saying, "Is this Joel?" Yep, that was you. So I saw the video of you on MSNBC here, right here in Chico. And then, shortly after that, you were in The New Yorker. So how did you even come up with this idea of a daring swim in the Seine?
Well, I live half the year in Paris, so I'm attuned to what's going on there. And throughout this year, both the president and the mayor of Paris have been swearing that they would swim in the Seine to show that the water would be okay for the Olympics, which, of course, just passed. And I was there in June. They were supposed to get in on June 23rd. They did not. I came back to the States and knew that they were supposed to get in on June 29th, and they did not. I was back in Paris on the 4th of July and decided that enough of this prevarication and procrastination, I will swim in the Seine. So I put on my blue Columbia Journalism School cap, my red Stanford T-shirt, a multicolored bathing suit, and went down to the Seine and took a dip. Incidentally, I first swam in the same spot 48 years ago for the cover story of a magazine called the Paris Metro, so I knew the water well. One of the other reasons that I wanted to do this was to applaud their effort to spend $1.5 billion to clean up the Seine so that everybody will be able to swim in it. Communities throughout the world are making these kind of financial and environmental efforts, and I thought they should be applauded. Indeed, I swam on the 4th of July. The little swim went viral because I had Associated Press covered it, and they sent out video and print stories about it. And I'd given exclusive coverage to The New Yorker, which I think is the best magazine in the world today. And their correspondent in Paris came and spent some time with me. So all of a sudden, this little swim, which embarrassed the mayor and the president, became viral, and of course, 2 weeks later, the mayor finally got in. A minister of sports had gotten in a couple days before her, and then when the Olympics came, I was down with everyone else watching the triathlon and the marathon at the Pont Alexandre Trois, and everything worked out well. The Paralympics, of course, were held a bit later. They postponed it a day or two, but they also got in the river. So everybody's getting in the river now. I was there last week and had a friend who wanted to go skinny dipping. And we went to a ceremony in late August called Go Topless Paris and learned that it is now illegal to go topless in Paris. €15,000 fine for going topless and a year in prison. So we scrapped our efforts to go skinny dipping because she didn't want to get arrested. I don't know why, or pay €15,000, which I don't think she had. And so we did not go skinny dipping in the river. But now, of course, with the Olympics over, skinny dipping and swimming is going to be a la mode everywhere. And many international capitals are cleaning up their rivers, Amsterdam and other places. So, and even Copenhagen, where they swim in the sea. Swimming in European capitals is the big vogue.
Now, you mentioned not getting arrested, But you could have been arrested for what you did on July 4th, swimming in this river, even though it had been cleaned up. So you avoided getting arrested, and you avoided E. coli.
Well, I was especially worried about being arrested because they swam in the Seine in the 1900 Olympics in Paris. By 1923, the pollution was so bad that it became against the law to swim in the Seine. As you know, I swam in the Seine in 1976. I did not get arrested. But I was a little bit worried about getting arrested this time because there was intense security prior to the Olympics. And there were police, very amicable policemen, throughout the city. When I swam on July 4th at 11:11 a.m., there were no cops. I had also invited the mayor to come with me, so City Hall knew I was going to do it. Whether they told the cops to lay off, I don't know. But I had a crowd of about 25 people who watched me swim in the same place that I'd swum in 76 in the shadow of Notre Dame Cathedral, which is, of course, still being repaired today. And everything went very smoothly. The water, extremely murky. If that's what you get for $1.5 billion cleanup, I don't know if I'd suggest it for the rivers in Northern California, which actually don't need to be cleaned up. Very murky, lots of algae, but I didn't see any E. coli. I will tell you that right now.
My guest is Reading author Joel Strati McClure, and he's telling us about his swim in the river in Paris that was cleaned up for the Olympics, and he swam in it on July 4th. And you described what you were wearing, a bathing suit, your T-shirt. But when you swam in it 48 years ago, you wore a wetsuit. Well, it was really filthy then.
No, it actually was not filthy. I had been transferred to Paris from Cape Town, South Africa, where I was working as a correspondent, and took my wetsuit and spear gun with me. So I just happened to be living on Île Saint-Louis in the middle of the river with a wetsuit and spear gun so that it was not difficult to put that on to go down to pose for a cover story for a magazine where I was apparently diving to find a gargoyle that had fallen into the river during the construction of Notre Dame 800 years ago. Didn't find a gargoyle, found a boot. Great story. Didn't get arrested then, didn't get arrested now, didn't get sick then, didn't get sick now. And as you know, I'm prepared once they lift the law of fining people for going topless to go skinny dipping with any woman who would like to go with me. Nancy.
Yeah. Hint, hint. Do you know what you're saying right now reminds me of a quote in a book that you put together. You edited this collection of articles from this magazine that you and some other young, fearless, and maybe even, I could think of a lot of adjectives for you and these friends who started this magazine called the Paris Metro. And one of the people who wrote articles in this magazine, his name was Keeney, and here's what he says about you, Joel. He says, "If Joel hated anything, it was obscurity. He set out to make the Metro famous. Our MO consisted of constant appearances across the upper reaches of Paris society, long boozy lunches, outrageous stunts, frequent interviews, elephantine schmoozing, attendance at any kind of event, and interminable soirees, all threaded with some generally outrageous promotion and ad selling. Often derided, this tactic actually worked, and contrary to persistent rumors, we were only arrested twice for disturbing the peace." So here's a guy that you worked with on this magazine that you and others put out, and he said, if you hated anything, it was obscurity, and made constant appearances and outrageous stunts. So do you think he characterized you there?
Well, we were breaking all sorts of taboos as an English language magazine in Paris in 1976, and the French didn't know what to make of us. They tapped our phones. They watched our activities. We did stories that were kind of taboo in French journalism at the time. You may recall that during that period of the 70s, it was the era of city magazines and investigative journalism and new journalism where you just let writers go to town, which is what we did. And in accompanying that, of course, we had to have advertising and make some money. And that I was publisher as well as a columnist and a reporter. And that did require tactics that sometimes bent things a little too far. But we were never seriously arrested. We would get fined. I did a number of stories where we were sued for libel. I remember once taking a helicopter in town, landing on the top of a hotel, and then swimming nude in the pool at the top of the hotel.
There's a photograph of that in this book, this anniversary issue.
There is. And another time going to Regine's, which was a famous—
But you did get the lifeguard in trouble for not being there at the pool.
So also going to nightclubs like Regine's, and I called her a courtesan or something, so she sued for a libel. I did a story on the Ritz Hotel, a doorman bigger than the Ritz, where he revealed some of the dirt behind the Ritz. And we were sued for libel by them. I still don't feel good going into the Ritz 50 years later. But the deal about getting sued for libel back then was that you admitted it, and you would have to pay one symbolic franc and put a disclaimer in the magazine. Now, I don't think we were guilty of libel in any of these cases, but we paid the one franc, put in the disclaimer, and life went on. So it was not too bad a thing to get nailed back in those days. And in the end, the magazine was very celebrated, and like any celebrated, oft-derided, to use one of John's words, events, we went broke.
Well, you mentioned they were spying on you. You tapped your phone, right? So that, I think, is kind of— you must have been important enough for them to tap your phone. But I think one time they interrupted to tell you, hey, speak in French, because you were speaking English on the phone these French eavesdroppers.
They did. You know, I don't think the highest level of intelligent policemen are assigned to tap phone listening. These people were obviously drunk when they told me to speak in French.
My guest is Joel Strati McClure, and he has written books about his walk around the Mediterranean, and the title of these three books, The Idiot and the Odyssey. So you're also known as The Idiot. I kind of beg to differ, Joel, with that, but you thought that was a good idea.
I have a blog called Follow the Idiot, and actually it was somebody who was doing PR for me in Australia in 2009 who said, you need a blog called Follow the Idiot. And I said, go ahead. So that it's been my blog for 15 years or so, and I enjoy being called the idiot. And obviously, do I think I'm an idiot? Of course not.
My guest is Reading author Joel Strati McClure, and he is a trekker who has written three books about this odyssey around the Mediterranean. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Reading author Joel Strati McClure, who has made international news for swimming in the river in Paris before the Olympics. I want to go back to the New Yorker article that was published on July 22nd, and their illustrations are just, you can really tell when they illustrate a person. Yeah, that's Joel. So there's this illustration of you in the river in Paris, holding an American flag, and there in the water, and this mentioned that It said, at the end of June, a curious summons appeared in the inbox of an American living in Paris. You're invited to watch me swim in the Seine in Paris on July 4th in exactly the same spot I took a dip for a magazine cover 48 years ago, it read. And it goes on, the email came from a Californian septuagenarian named Joel Strati McClure. This is the New Yorker now, in talk of the town. Here you are. So this email was from you. Attached was a JPEG of a 1976 edition of the Paris Metro, which featured him in a wetsuit and a scuba mask holding a spear gun, and you just told us how you happened to have a spear gun handy, holding a spear gun in one hand and an umbrella in the other with the headline, Our Men in the Seine, gets to the bottom of the dirty river and comes back alive. So you had told us you invited the mayor and President Macron to swim in the river, and well, he didn't anyway. I would like for you to read a little bit of this article in The New Yorker about you.
Yes, this was written by Lauren Collins, who is The New Yorker's correspondent and has been in Paris for the past 10 years. and this is what she wrote. With a showman's flair, Strati McClure ripped off his trunks, revealing a multicolored Speedo, brackets, a moule beat, literally dick molder in highly impolite French. Brackets, and well-toned biceps. He's a member of U.S. Masters Swimming and sometimes competes. Days earlier, water quality researchers had detected more than 10 times the acceptable level of E. coli bacteria in the Seine. Brackets, Olympics organizers have expressed confidence that the water will be safe by the start of the games. Brackets. Strati McClure was not deterred. He scrambled down a set of stairs, snapped on goggles, and pushed off into the river, freestyling toward the Pont Saint-Louis at a steady clip. A pair of ducks floated past him. In the distance, one could make out bleachers, rows of empty bleachers erected for the Olympic triathlon and open water swimming races.
This is Reading author Joel Strati McClure, and he is reading something not that he wrote. It's not by him. It is about him and his swim in the river in Paris on the 4th of July. Now, I mentioned that you, I described you as a Reading author. You also live in Paris, but you are from Reading, and you were not born there. You were born in North Dakota. So how did you get to Reading, Joel?
North Dakota at the time was a very popular state, but a lot of people left it for California. And my mother got divorced and drove us across the country in 1953, remarried a doctor in San Francisco, and moved to Reading because back then it was a town of 12,000 people, Democratic controlled, I may add, and a wonderful place to fish and hunt and to practice as a physician. So many doctors moved up then from San Francisco, my stepfather being one of them. And I went to school there through high school, had a wonderful upbringing, hunting, fishing, and everything else that came with Northern California in those days. And then went to Stanford, Columbia, and lived outside the country for 40 years. In 2009, my mother was 90, and I felt I should be with my mother as her oldest son. As one of the two, she drove across the United States from North Dakota with, as she transitions to her next, her final address, in fact. And I figured that looking at the actuarial chart, she would probably die 6 months a year, maybe. I could handle Reading 6 months or a year. My mother, however, lived another 13 years, died at 102, and I wrote a story about how mothers have various influences on their children, but mine really tricked me. And when I got there, she at some point during the intervening years, she checked the actuarial charts and said she would live until she was 107. I believed her. Consequently, I bought a house and some land that now I can't get rid of. So I'm still in Reading.
So you were the son of an adventurer. Here's this woman living in North Dakota. She takes her two sons and off she goes to San Francisco. So I'm sure then, because I was thinking of all these adventures you've had, your mother saying, I'm sure, Joel, going to do all these things because she was adventurous herself, it sounds like.
She definitely encouraged me. I remember that when I was growing up, I would read people like Thor Heyerdahl and all these other world adventurers who would go off on pursuits. And even at the age of 10, I was a fan of Greek myths where there would be a quest and a fulfillment, Jason and the Argonauts, all sorts of different adventures. So I grew up very adventurous. And of course, in Northern California at that time, there would be all sorts of adventures to get in, usually recreationally influenced. And I remember that she got me involved in different things, a program on Lake Tahoe when I was a sophomore in high school, an exchange program in Germany when I was a junior in high school. I was teaching English in Hong Kong when I was a freshman at Stanford, and life just went on.
Now, I want to go back to this trip that you and your mother had two sons. And you mentioned your brother. He's a younger brother. You mentioned Lars in this 40th anniversary issue of the Paris Metro, which you edited. And at the time this article mentioned him, he was 22 years old and a pilot.
Actually, Lars was yet a younger brother, born in 1955.
I thought that's what I said, did I? Younger than you.
Right, but when we took the trip across the States.
Oh, I gotcha. Right. Okay, so.
Four boys.
Oh, my goodness. So this younger brother, Lars, thank you for the correction, was 22 at the time the Metro was being published in Paris. He visits, he's a pilot. And then, I almost hate to ask, but he was honored for something your brother Lars did. And why was Lars honored?
Well, Lars was killed fighting a fire in Ukiah in 2001, 23 years ago. And you may recall this, it was a big event at the time. Two firefighting pilots' planes collided above the fire, which was started by meth dealers. And indeed, he was honored in a dramatic ceremony in Reading where I was privileged to be one of the speakers and give a eulogy for him. And I remember saying this many years later that the fire is out, but our memories of you are ablaze. And that date has just passed, so I happened to post it on social media and was very happy that it got a lot of reactions.
And he was way too young.
Anyone who dies is way too young. But no, he had not yet turned 40. He had two children and, of course, a wife, shattered families, and obviously had a major impact on my mother, who thought until her death that he was visiting her regularly in Reading. So I didn't ask for too many details about that.
Well, now you mentioned going to Stanford and you were in pre-med. And I was wondering if your stepdad was an influence that you thought, oh, I think I'll major in pre-med.
It seemed so easy at the time. It seemed so easy at the time. I would go, I would become a doctor, I'd come back to Reading, I'd get a house on a hill, and I'd have a blonde wife. And this was in 1966. It seemed so easy. Who would question it? But you may recall that during that period, there was the Vietnam War, which even very early, 1965, I can remember when I was first influenced about the possibility that it might not be a good war. There were all sorts of liberation movements, women's lib, gay rights, and everything else. There was Stop the University. So my career in pre-med lasted exactly 3 months.
Oh.
And I do have a house on a hill in Reading at the moment, and a friend of mine visited and said, well, you got one out of the three. No doctor, no blonde, but there you go.
So when you decide, okay, being medicine, that's not for me. So what did you study when you were at Stanford?
No, I didn't say being medicine's not for me. Chemistry was too difficult. I could not handle it. And there was no reason that I should be able to handle it. I'm not a chemist.
But you did study
Well, I went into religious studies for a while. Then I went into East Asian studies because I wound up teaching in Hong Kong. And again, it was the Vietnam era, and I wanted to learn about the history of that area as I adamantly opposed the Vietnam War at the time. And then I wound up in English and creative writing, which was great because it gave me a foundation for what I wound up doing the rest of my life, writing.
So then next, off you go to study journalism at Columbia. You made some really good contacts there. And you were in the neighborhood when Woodstock happened.
Well, Woodstock was prior to Columbia. Woodstock was in 1969, and I was working on a newspaper in Burlington, Vermont. And a friend and I saw the slate of bands that were going to play and asked an editor if we could go cover it. And, of course, he said, go have a good time. Nobody knew Woodstock would become Woodstock on the Thursday before Woodstock. But once we got there and the crowds and the rain and the show must go on attitude continued, Woodstock became, I actually called it the death of hippiedom, even though, of course, it was a very successful event. And the death of hippiedom didn't occur until 6 months later when there was a shooting at Altamont. But it was a very, very intriguing thing. And its reputation was big at the time as a news story, but it wasn't until the movie came out that it really became the famous thing that it is today. I was writing in a column in Hollywood between 2004 and 2009, and the organizers of Woodstock had an anniversary. And I went, and you know, everybody has great feelings about it, but nobody made any money. It was very uncomfortable in terms of crowds and food and rain. And it was a sea of mud. But it was a great story. It was my first really good front page story on a newspaper. I was a junior in college at the time. And it's a wonderful event. And I'm still, I was interviewed for Life magazine on one anniversary of Woodstock 15, 20 years ago. And they're doing a compendium of memories, oral and written, that are in a library that's there now. So it's become a very iconic moment in American life, and I was just fortunate to have been there at the right time.
My guest is author and journalist who lives in Reading, has a house on a hill in Reading, and he has written three books about his trek around the Mediterranean, The Idiot and The Odyssey. So you were got to start with pretty exciting assignment there. Off there you are, junior in college, and you go cover Woodstock. So then after journalism, you get a degree in journalism from Columbia. You make some contacts of people I think you're still in touch with today. And then where did you go, Joel?
Well, I had lived in Paris for 6 months between Stanford and Columbia and had gone there to meet a co-ed at Stanford and continue our delightful relationship. And you probably wouldn't believe this, but her father made her fly back to the United States on the day that I arrived in Paris. So I arrived in Paris speaking only German, no French, knowing nobody, wound up through a strange array of events getting settled in an apartment in Paris, meeting another American woman who was living there and studying. And after Columbia, we went back to Paris to continue our life together. But, you know, the weather in Paris, despite the river cleanup, is not good in the winter.
Oh, it's terrible. And the days are so short. Night goes on forever. And it's rainy and dark in the winter in Paris.
It bothered me a lot
Let me add, I love Paris. I really do. And one of your articles are about the romantic places in Paris. But, again, what you were just saying, wintertime, you don't want to be in Paris.
Well, I live in Paris now. For some reason, the days don't bother me as much, and certainly not as much as the hot days in Reading during the summer. In any event, the woman I was with at the time and I drove down through Africa, spent a year driving down through Africa, and I wound up in Cape Town where I was hired with an American news service and spent 3 years covering Africa. Wonderful period. South Africa at that time, of course, was under apartheid, which was a very heinous governmental system. But I traveled all over Muhammad Ali fighting in Zaire.
You covered Muhammad Ali. The rumble in the jungle.
Coup d'etat in Mozambique, OPEC meetings in Ghana. I was killed, in fact, in Liberia in around 1975. I had gone to cover the Tolberts, who were—
I might remind people this is before the days of iPhones and texting and—
No, this was pure telex time. And I had stopped at the AP office in Johannesburg just for lunch with somebody who was going to cover my stuff for me when I was out of the country, and said I was going to Liberia to do a story on Tolbert. There were two brothers. One was president, one was minister of finance. I was going to do a story on the minister of finance, and I left to do that. And he was killed just as I arrived in a private airplane crash. And what happened in Africa, or many places back in those days, there would be embargo. They would shut down all communication for 48 hours to prevent any sort of coup d'etat or anything that might be in the planning. In this case, it was just an airplane accident. And the people in Johannesburg thought I had been killed, too, because that's what I was going to do a story on. So they wrote a terrible obituary about me that was really kind of insulting. And in any event, since then, I keep my own obituary handy, and it's much more positive than theirs was.
In fact, in your book, The Idiot and the Odyssey, you say you carry a copy in your backpack at this time of your obituary.
I do.
You carry a copy in your backpack.
If you'd read the one that was written in 1975 when I was allegedly killed in a plane crash with Tolbert, I can't remember his first name, you'd carry yours too. No, I update it regularly. I have funeral plans and everything else at the ready. You never know.
So you're making it easy for your children and grandchildren then.
I've tried to make it as easy as possible for my children and grandchildren. My grandchildren, the reason I'm living in Paris at the moment is my son, who was raised in the South, born and raised in the South of France, is an actor. He was in Hollywood for 13 years and then moved back to Paris because he wanted to raise his children in a more refined environment. So they've been living there for the past couple of years, and I have a pied-à-terre there and go over frequently. but so, yeah, I'm if I have any wisdom to impart, if I have anything I've learned in life that might help someone else, my two grandchildren are the only people who really want to hear it, who have to hear it, and who might benefit from it.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with author Joel Strotty McClure. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Reading author Joel Strotty McClure, who has written three books about his walk around the Mediterranean, The Idiot and the Odyssey. Well, I read your anniversary issue of this magazine that you and young people put together, and I found it so interesting, that period of time, for example, and you say on the cover, 50 articles, 200 photographs. And for example, there was an article about feminism, and you mentioned it earlier here in the United States, what it was like. And when I read what French women feminists were like, I thought, gosh, I'd rather have been with the French feminists than the American ones. And how did they differ?
Well, that was the 40th anniversary issue. So the articles in that compilation were written from 1976 to 1978. But even today, with the Me Too movement, there's a distinct variation in the reaction between American feminists and American women and French women. I don't want to go into a light attempt to define it, because it's a very complex cultural, sexual, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual difference between American culture and American women, and British culture and British women, and French culture and French women. They're each raised with such a large amount of baggage, as we all are, that they've been influenced by a variety of different things. They're great examples of French feminism, but they're also great examples of rebutting some of the extremes of feminism that have been seen in the United States, particularly with the Me Too thing. Back in the days in 1976, the revolution, if it was a revolution, started in 1968 with all you may recall the backlashes that occurred throughout the world in 1968. And so the French were there at the genesis of this movement, but they just took a different path. I think it's too difficult to define it in without a lot of detail.
Well, that's an example of an article that appeared in your anniversary issue, the 40th anniversary issue. But there are also lighthearted ones, like one woman said, I think I'll write about breads in Paris and where you can get the best bread.
Well, the best bread in Paris is much more important to the French and to me and to most people than their attitude about feminism.
Even though you were writing for English speakers, like Americans, the French, you had a lot of French readers to your English magazine.
And most of them couldn't read English. It was considered very avant-garde to be carrying around a copy of the Paris Metro. And we did break a lot of good stories. But we also did a lot of practical how-to stories, because that was part of the trend of these city magazines at the time. One of my favorite covers, which I occasionally allude to today, is Where to Go in Paris, about the best toilets. And I brought that back just before the Olympics, because it is very difficult to find a free public toilet in Paris unless you know where they are. And I know where they are. And during the Olympics, they also brought out a lot of porta potties and all sorts of other things. But I still think one of the most fascinating, if I do another book, and I have no intention to because I prefer action rather than writing, it would be about Where to Go in Paris. And I would tell you where the best toilets are.
Well, I mentioned, even though these articles were written in the mid 1976 to 79, I think people would want to read it today. I certainly enjoyed it. So I want to tell the title again. They can Google it, look it up on Amazon. It's the 40th anniversary issue of the Paris Metro. And I think people today would find, oh, well, that's interesting. And Pierre Salinger, he wrote for them. So I think people would be interested in reading this. On the cover is people who were in Paris many years ago. Here's a dirty building. This is your office building on the cover.
Wonderful 16th century hotel pavillon. Great place that we got for a song, because they were going to renovate it. And of course, it didn't happen. So we stayed there for a few years. The interesting thing about this publication is when we had a 40th birthday party in Paris, anniversary of the magazine, which I put together, we all met for drinks at La Tour d'Argent and had a wonderful weekend reminiscing. It was suggested that we do a book, and as you can see, that's a very well-designed book. Mm-hmm. It became a much bigger project than we initially thought it would. But I asked everybody who had been writing there 40 years ago, who was still alive, to write a memory or whatever they wanted to, contribute photographs, and to get the fodder to put that book together. And absolutely no one said no. Everyone was very enthusiastic. Nobody got paid. Everybody came to the party. It was a great success. So something happened, some sort of chemistry occurred back then that brought people together and created something memorable. Many of them went on to have very successful professions. They're very well-known people who were involved.
Journalists and writers.
Yeah. Roger Cohen of the New York Times, many, many people.
And I'm mentioning that most of them were writers, but you have an article, and I'm reading along in English. I turn a page, and here's a whole article in French. I thought, what? I thought this magazine was in English. And it turns out that this guy was a doorman. Oh, my goodness.
One of my brilliant ideas was to get a young communist doorman at the Ritz Hotel to tell us the stories about what really goes on in the kitchen and behind the scenes at the Ritz. And this 18-year-old young communist, who later refused to have ever been interviewed or photographed by me, even though, of course, we had the photographs, spilled the dirt on the Ritz. He was the son of a family I knew very well and had known for a long time. There was a little rupture for about 5 years after this came out because, of course, he'd gotten his job because his father was working as a contractor, an electrician for the hotel. Father got fired, kid got fired, we got sued. I'm afraid to go back into the hotel. Even today, I can't believe it. I always wonder if anybody's going to recognize me. Of course, they would not.
Well, it was definitely not a flattering article about the Ritz.
It was a great article.
That's a flattering.
No, we were not there to flatter. We were there to critique. And that turned out to be a very stupid decision on my part because all the other hotels and airlines and luxury brands who were advertising with us took a look at that and said, is that what they're going to do to us, and canceled their ads. In fact, the Paris Review, another very good American magazine up there with the New Yorker, did a story about us a few months ago earlier this year. I think it was published in January, talking about the Paris Metro, and mentioned that about one of my brilliant ideas was to criticize an advertiser.
Well, I remember another article in here mentioned the French politesse, and I learned that the hard way because an American, I run up to this conductor in the train station, and I blurted out my question to him, and he gave me this icy look because I did not first say bonjour. So I think what the information you had in here for us Americans would be very handy.
It's a wonderful little book. I'm very proud of it. It took a lot of time and effort. It's well designed. It turned out very well. I like it a lot. And French politesse, true even today. There's really only one thing you have to know about going to France and dealing with the French, and that is to say, every time you talk to anyone, before you say anything, just say bonjour. The day will go a lot better. I still occasionally will make a mistake and forget to say bonjour, and I am immediately reminded by whoever I'm speaking to.
Oh, yeah.
They will say derisively, bonjour. So it's a very simple thing that, of course, most Americans don't know. I was just there for the Olympics and did a piece on a radio station there where the guy was saying how the American athletes in the Olympic Village were spoiled and didn't like the food and thought it was too far to go to the events, and that we're all very spoiled people as Americans, and they may be right. Everybody here feels quite entitled, certainly today at least, in this country. You know, it's just different cultures.
I mentioned that I think people would enjoy this more recent. This is from 2016, this 40th anniversary issue of articles written back in the mid-1970s.
Well, those articles are actually memories written about the 1970s by these people in 2016.
Thank you. Yes. These are people who were writing those articles at the time have contributed to this. But I also want to encourage people to consider your book, The Idiot and the Odyssey, Walking the Mediterranean, because I read this book 2008, I think it was, and after reading your anniversary issue of the Paris Metro, I got down my copy of The Idiot and the Odyssey and reread some things that, oh my goodness, I didn't remember. A lot of mentions of the Paris Metro, for example, But people might be wondering, well, here's this young guy in Paris, and he's meeting all these attractive blondes. And how did he have children? You mentioned you have two children now. So who was their mother, and how did that come about?
Their mother actually worked for the Paris Metro. She was not their mother, obviously, when she was working at the Paris Metro. But after we went bankrupt, we got together and were together for 20-some years. And because of the weather in Paris, I left once for Cape Town. This time I left for the south of France. And my children were raised in the south of France and now live in the south of France and in Paris. So it worked out. It worked out very well for everyone. The Paris Metro is not dead. There is a team of producers, writers, including the people who wrote Mad Men, trying to get the financing for a series or a movie about the Paris Metro. With the success of Emily in Paris and the failure of a film called French Dispatch a couple of years ago, the ground is ripe for this kind of project if all the elements will marry, and that's taking longer than I or anyone else expected. It may or may not happen. But I still live on with the books. I'm going to, an Australian group has engaged me to read from the books, talk about the books, and lead a guided tour on the first day of the hike I took next May, for example.
Well, you were still married when you took your first leg, I want to call that, of the trek. And was this wife, she sounds beautiful, the mother of your children, is she the one that says, hey, you should call this the idiot in the Odyssey?
No, it was actually, when I took the first steps in 1998, I did not want to write any stories. I did not want to write a book. I wanted to go on a solitary monastic walking meditation around the Mediterranean. I had no idea it would take 20 years. I had no idea I was walking in the footsteps of Homer and Odysseus. And I certainly had no idea I'd write three books called The Idiot and the Odyssey about it. So the title didn't occur until well after I was divorced and was with my second wife around 2008. And she woke up one morning at 4 a.m. and said, The Idiot and the Odyssey, which, of course, is a play on The Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer's two books, a great title. So I owe it to her. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal wrote a story about the swim that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the editor had probably a very industrious intern working for him. The intern went back and saw a story in the Reading Record Searchlight that appeared 10 years ago, detailing the fact that my second wife gave me the title of the book, and they used that in the Wall Street Journal story. All these things keep coming around to either haunt you or applaud you as life goes on.
Well, if you had a mother who lived to be over 100, Joel, we'll look forward to more writing from you. Thank you for coming in today and telling us about all your adventures and your books.
Great to see you again, Nancy. And as I've said before, you are the most attentive reader to stuff that the people you interview write that everybody should want to get on this show, and everybody does. And some don't.
I do enjoy reading, as you see. Let me remind listeners that the title, your trilogies, The Idiot and the Odyssey, and the first one, Walking the Mediterranean. The author is Joel Strati McClure. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Travel, alchemy for the soul. Travel has a way of molding, melting, twisting, and shaping our souls. When we least expect it, and despite our feeble attempts at keeping life predictable or seemingly safe, we are thrust into new, uncontrolled situations. If we are open to them, there is a purification that can arise, allowing our inner light to shine. However, if we first learn to trust, not just any kind of trust, but the trust that comes right after experiencing something that you might thought have killed you, and instead of retreating, you push on and take more steps into the scary unknown. Travel has always been alchemy for my soul. allowing growth and connectivity in ways that could not have happened had I stayed in the comforts of my original home. Quote, "You're just a Chico baby and will never leave this town," end quote. Powerful words directed at me when I was a small child by a well-intending grandfather. However, the damage was done, the challenge accepted, and in my attempts to prove him wrong, I began my quest. Traveling to over 36 countries, I felt inspired and alive on a deeper level than I thought possible. With the intention to visit more, my book is about a recent journey. The first method to alchemize your life is to begin to let go of fear and step into trust. Trust that the universe is showing you a path to your greater good, whether you can see the benefit or not at the time. I would often ask myself if what I'm afraid of is really a threat, or is it just a natural reaction to something unknown? A check-in provides a quick assessment to see if there is any harm on my horizon, or am I reacting from the primitive part of my brain that wants to flee at the slightest uncomfortable situation? If that were the case, I would run away from any new encounter. Lisa Carson.
I could have bought a Porsche. As far as the undignified collapse into male menopause goes, living with two cats is almost noble. Sharing my soul space with retired goddesses, asking them to relocate heaven and to offer their blessings on my fear-soaked bones before time reclaims me like lost luggage. Celebrating their company as if every day were a ritual of prayers and holy feasts. Mimicking Hercules, cleaning litter boxes as if they were stables of a great herd, understanding that janitorial duties are a calling and a humbling reward. Asking them to consecrate these stanzas, guarding them against the excesses of ego and the sins of inept grammar. Teaching me to lessen my Baroque appetites, not choosing women half my age, never drinking alone, eating less and tasting more. No flashy car to rev my dusty engine, no shiny chains worn like a glamorous noose, just the rumble of soothing purrs and the jungle songs of wild animals, happy to tame a man allergic in his earlier years to common sense. And this is Robert Chancy.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.